Thank you. You may be seated. I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals for our third and final argument of this afternoon. I understand that counsel have all checked in and are ready to go. I'll introduce our panel before we get started. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So with that, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Brittany Kitchen, and I'm here today on behalf of Aetna. This case involves the bare-bones, baseball-style arbitration procedure in Chapter 1467 of the Texas Insurance Code. This is a relatively new statutory scheme, and this court may actually be the first appellate court to interpret it. In light of that, we thought it might be a little helpful to give some context on the purpose behind the procedure and why we have such a minuscule administrative record here and why there's such a highly deferential standard of review and how that all fits in with the purpose of this arbitration procedure. In 2019, Texas passed comprehensive legislation aimed at protecting Texans from receiving exorbitant out-of-network medical bills in situations where the patient has little choice over who provides their medical care, such as in an emergency. The administrative arbitration procedure we're talking about today was part of that legislation. And now it's called arbitration, but that is in name only. As you might have gathered from the very small administrative record that I've alluded to, it is nothing like traditional arbitration. There are no briefs, there's no discovery, there are no depositions, and often there are no lawyers. And that was by design. The legislature made this process very simple and streamlined because of the volume of out-of-network medical bills that the legislature knew would be addressed through this process. The Texas Department of Insurance, which I'm going to refer to as TDI, publishes a report on the arbitration process that's required by the legislation that created this process. And as of June 2021, which is the latest data available, there were over 10,000 requests for arbitration being submitted to TDI each month. So it's a large volume of cases we're talking about here. Given the enormous number of requests, as you'll see on pages 98 to 101 of the record, the arbitration is facilitated almost entirely through an online portal that is maintained by the Texas Department of Insurance. The way it works is that when a party's dissatisfied with the amount that was paid on an out-of-network medical bill, they go into the portal, they submit some very basic information, and they submit the request. The parties then have 30 days to participate in an informal settlement teleconference, and if the case doesn't settle, then it proceeds to arbitration. And the arbitration can either be done by an agreed arbitrator or one appointed by TDI. And in this case, it was an arbitrator appointed by TDI from a list of approved arbitrators that they maintain. The legislation that created this process instructed TDI to create this list and to give preference to arbitrators who are knowledgeable and experienced in applicable principles of contract and insurance law and the healthcare industry generally. So these are arbitrators who typically are going to be familiar with the type of documents that they're looking at here, which are very few because of the nature of the process. As you'll see on pages 77 and 78 and 92 to 96 of the record, the actual arbitration is conducted entirely by submission. Nobody's driving to Houston and going to an office building, sitting in a conference room, and spending 10 minutes every 3 hours talking to the arbitrator or anything like that. The parties receive an email from the arbitrator. He sets a deadline for them to submit information they want him to consider, and then he makes a single determination, the reasonable amount for the healthcare services that were provided by the out-of-network provider to the health plan's enrollee. That's the only thing the arbitrator gets to decide.
And I assume that the arbitrator has a way, because I know that there's a lot of discussion about these 10 categories, So if the arbitrator doesn't feel that he or she has sufficient information, I guess there's a way to say, hey,
yes,
I want to know something about 0.789 or whatever.
Yes, the arbitrator has the ability to tell the parties, hey, I'm going to need this information in order to decide this. And, you know, the parties can respond to that. And here there was no such request made. So the arbitrator makes one decision, the reasonable amount, and that's by design. And even if a party submits nothing to the arbitrator, he's still required to make a decision. And that's in TDI's rules related to this process. If a party doesn't submit anything, the arbitrator is instructed to issue, make the determination as to the reasonable amount using whatever information is available. So this is clearly a very slimmed down process. It's meant to be efficient, cost effective. And the ultimate policy goal was to create economic incentives for the parties to come together at a reasonable amount. So eventually you have more providers coming in network, you have less of these disputes, and eventually in a perfect world, this arbitration procedure becomes unnecessary because the parties have arrived at a rate that this process dictates, and they're not, you know, pushing it to arbitration to see how much more money they can get anymore. And as you said, Judge, when determining the reasonable amount, the arbitrator has to take into account or evaluate 10 specific factors that the legislature listed in Chapter 1467. And it's important to note that while the arbitrator must consider these factors, he has complete discretion on how much weight to assign to them. There's no instruction from the legislature saying, you know, factor 6 weighs more heavily in favor of the reasonable amount than factor 10. It's totally up to the arbitrator. He just has to take them into consideration. Once the arbitrator decides what the reasonable amount is, he provides the parties with a very simple written decision. And this is also laid out in the statutes. The arbitrator just has to determine whether the out-of-network provider's billed charges or the health plan's payment, as those amounts were last modified during the informal settlement teleconference that I mentioned, is the closest to the reasonable amount that the arbitrator has arrived at.
So when it goes up to the trial court and then to us,
yes.
what is it that the trial court is supposed to do? What sort of discretion
Sure.
does the court get to exercise? What do they look at if there's a very limited record? I mean, it's,
Sure.
how does this all work?
I appreciate that it is difficult to make a decision with such a small administrative record. And that is why the legislature chose the highly deferential substantial evidence standard of review. If there's something in the record that supports the arbitrator's decision, the court should uphold it.
And so is it really more like an abuse of discretion
yes,
kind of standard? Where
that's what we believe, yes. Okay. Because the nature of this process, if you have 10,000 requests a month, and I think roughly 40% based on the last data proceed to arbitration, if everybody's filing an appeal on this and it's a, you know, we end up having to brief these before the arbitrator to, you know, make it unassailable on appeal, it just becomes untenable. The system isn't going to work like it was designed to.
Right. I'm trying to, before we get to what the courts and what we look at and
sure.
what standards we need to apply, I am curious about one thing.
Sure.
As far as the arbitrator goes, I understand that one of the things that they look at is this whole the GeoZip area, mm-hmm. the FAIR health benchmarking database. Can we assume that if there's insufficient data from that actual specific place, that they can actually look at other GeoZip data from areas that are in close proximity? Is that?
I don't know what that's not in the statute. I don't know what the arbitrator might do. There's not information like that in the record here, so I think we have to assume he didn't in this case. But I will say that the methodology that Aetna provided to the arbitrator explaining how it calculates the out-of-network rate is based on Medicare rates, which do have a GeoZip factor.
And, all right.
So, yes, this is highly deferential substantial evidence review. The reviewing court should not substitute its judgment for that of the arbitrator on the weight of the evidence. And unfortunately, without the benefit of findings of fact from the trial court, we can only assume that that's what they did, because there is some evidence in the record to support the arbitrator's decision. And it's on page 97 of the record. It's Aetna's explanation of how it pays out-of-network providers similarly situated for the same services. And, you know, it's there, and since it's there, it should have been affirmed.
What is your position about, you know, I guess two things, very open-ended questions. What do you think we are supposed to review, and what do you think the appropriate standard of review for us is in looking at this case?
Sure. It's my understanding the Court of Appeals in this situation would do the substantial evidence review de novo. There wouldn't be deference to the trial court. It would be as though you were the trial court in this scenario. And I'm sorry, what was the second part?
Well, you basically answered both.
Okay.
And that is, we're actually looking at what the arbitrator did.
Yes.
Is what your position is.
Yes.
And we have to apply the same substantial evidence
yes.
that's in the APA that the
yes.
trial court should have looked at or would have looked at.
Yes.
And at bottom, your argument is basically if there's anything that supports what this arbitrator did, it's enough.
I think given the system that we're working with here, I think yes, because there aren't rules of evidence that apply. There's no discovery. There are no depositions. The parties aren't making legal arguments to the arbitrator. It's literally done online and by email. This is not a very fleshed out process. And whether we think that's the right way or not, that was a policy decision that the legislature made, and we have to use their system.
Is the legislature worried that people might stop practicing emergency medicine out of network?
That's a question for Representative Oliverson or Senator Oliverson.
if your position, we ignore what the trial court did altogether. We don't even look at what they really did. We go back to, it's a de novo review. Is there, in this whole substantial evidence thing, would you say it's similar or tantamount to just a little bit more than a scintilla? I think there is some case law out there.
Yes.
I can't remember if that's in your brief.
It is. It's more than a mere scintilla, which I think we have here. We have, you know, Aetna's explanation that the amount it paid initially was the amount that it pays similarly situated providers for the same services. It calculates that amount using a defined internal methodology that's tied to what Medicare would pay, and that's very common in the industry. I know that's not in the record, but I submit to you that is a common practice. And because that evidence is there and it supports the arbitrator's conclusion as to the reasonable amount, I think his decision has to be upheld.
You know, if you can't answer this question, don't. And don't try to answer it if you really can't. but, you know, since we are doing a de novo review, can you explain to us how $2,800 is a reasonable amount to pay a physician who provides emergency vascular surgery?
Sure. So to be clear, that's not the reasonable amount that the arbitrator arrived at. The arbitrator decided that $4,286 was the reasonable amount, and the legislation requires that whichever last settlement offer is closer to that is the binding award amount. The provider has no discretion.
Could you explain to us then how $4,000, whatever it is you just said, that it would be the specific amount, how that would be reasonable?
Sure. I mean, it's almost double what Aetna offered as its final pre-arbitration settlement offer, which was 380% of the Medicare rates. And I think I can't guess as to how the arbitrator weighed that. And, you know, that's not really what we're here to do. We're not here to, you know, figure out how he weighed the evidence. We just need to know that there is some evidence in the record that supports his decision as to the reasonable amount.
Do you concede that, you know, Appalee will probably say that, you know, Medicare rates should be the lowest threshold, that you go up from there?
Sure, and we're certainly not saying Medicare rates are even a factor here, but it is part of Aetna's methodology and part of its explanation as to how it pays similarly situated providers and how it paid the provider in this situation. And under substantial evidence, there may be evidence that preponderates against the arbitrator's decision, and we may disagree about whether or not the decision was correct. But at the end of the day, all we're looking for is if there's some evidence in the record to support the determination as to the reasonable amount.
And I'm trying to think, did Aetna provide specific data documentation to them in addition to just the generalities that they kind of already have at their fingertips?
It's on page 15 of the record. You can see where Aetna, you know, and again, lawyers aren't really involved with this process, so you have people, you know, billing people a lot of the time, filling these out, given the volume, and they do provide an explanation as to how the reimbursement is calculated, and it does reference the Medicare factors. And I would also say that the reasonable amount here could have been as high as $11,000, and the award amount still would have been Aetna's last settlement offer because it would be closer than the Appalese last offer.
And that was the legislature's decision.
That is in the statute, correct. And I think the policy goal is to try to drive the parties to meet in the middle and stop taking the risk that, you know, take a sure thing rather than risk the difference.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
Time is up. Response?
May it please the court, my name is Javeria Syed, and I represent Appellee Dr. Michael Nazarian Association Limited, which I will refer to herein as Dr. Nazarian. This case originated when Dr. Nazarian initiated arbitration pursuant to Chapter 1467 of the Texas Insurance Code in order to get fair pay for the services he rendered to an Aetna enrollee. Appellant raises two issues, which appears to actually be one issue, just stated differently. Appellant asks the court whether the trial court erred in finding that the arbitrator's decision is not supported by substantial evidence. The purpose of my argument here today is to demonstrate that the trial court did not err when it concluded that the arbitrator's decision was not supported by substantial evidence and consequently made a statutorily required determination as to the amount due to Dr. Nazarian. In its arbitration submission, Aetna either provided non-responsive answers or deferred to Dr. Nazarian regarding answering the 10 factors. It is clear that more than a mere scintilla of evidence is not present, and a reasonable mind could not have come to the conclusion it did when it found in favor for Aetna. Therefore, the trial court acted entirely within the substantial evidence review procedures called for by Chapter 1467.
Is the trial court authorized by statute to set what it adjudges to be a reasonable amount, or does it have to send it back?
So the only way, whenever it is appealed, it's actually specifically written within the statute. It's 1467.089C, and it says in there that the court is allowed to determine the amount due based on a substantial evidence standard of review. This case cannot be remanded back to arbitration. It is not possible.
Well, you'd say that, I mean, you would at least concede that there's some ambiguity there. But in that, if you look at the substantial evidence review and you go to the APA, and then it's very limited in what a court can do, a reviewing court can do, based on the factors that are delineated within the substantial evidence review, you concede that, right? I mean, it basically says all the reviewing court can do is either affirm or reverse, in essence, and send it back.
I understand your point. I would like to make a really quick point on that. What the APA does say is that when a court is reviewing a state agency decision, here this is not a state agency decision. The TDI does not make a decision here. These are arbitrators that are independent contractors, and I don't know how these independent contractors who are arbitrators are even reviewed, how their resumes are.
So you wouldn't consider them to be agents or independent contractors of a state agency?
I would not consider, because it's first come, first serve with these arbitrators. Whoever submitted their application first, they're the ones who are on.
But there's some case law out there, isn't there, that in some ways kind of tells us, at least I think the Austin Court of Appeals has some decisions that says that in these agency determinations that they're kind of one and the same, in that they are an agent, if you will, of the agency. Isn't that true?
Well, my understanding of it when I read those cases is that a state agency decision would be like, for example, Texas Board of Law Examiners. They do this day in and day out. For example, whenever they decide to, you know, restrict someone's license or something like that, they know this stuff back and forth, you know. I've seen some arbitrators who don't even have any experience in this area. When I called the TDI to ask them how arbitrators are determined, it's a first come, first serve basis. I would also like to point out the way that these arbitrators are selected is that the TDI doesn't just find an arbitrator and selects this arbitrator. There are five arbitrators that are selected. Two of them are struck out by the insurance company, two of them are struck out by the physician. and the one remaining is the one who arbitrates the case. What I would like to also add is that the insurance companies utilize the system so much more. So when these arbitrators are paid by these people, I mean, there's no safeguard in that. There's no safeguard because they're going to say, well, insurance companies use this so much more. I'm going to be struck out next time. There aren't any safeguards with that.
But the law's written that way. And no matter even no matter how much we may personally agree with Dr. Nazarian and understand and sympathize with this frustration, we are still limited by the law. And that's just the way the law is. I mean, obviously, that argument would be something that would have to be brought forward to the legislature on the processes that they use in selecting these arbitrators under Section 1467. You agree with that, right?
Well,
you understand that?
I understand the point that you're saying, but I believe that the law does allow for this court to determine the amount due. I believe that even the substantial evidence standard of review, if they are conflicting, what the law states, and Texas is clear about that, is that the newly enacted statute was the one that would govern. And because Statute 1467 says that the court is allowed to determine the amount due, that would override the APA law.
Are we allowed to determine the amount due or just pick the higher? I mean, if we think that the arbitrator went the wrong direction, I mean, we couldn't do anything, or the trial court couldn't have done anything other than going with Dr. Nazarian's last offer, right?
Well, and that is such a great question.
We can say, okay, we think it's worth $50,000, right?
I think that's a great question. It doesn't necessarily state within the statute. It just says that the judge is allowed to determine the amount due.
The judge can't look behind the decision if there's substantial evidence to support it.
I completely agree with you, but I do not believe that there's substantial evidence to support.
Tell me why what Aetna submitted isn't some evidence to support the arbitrator's decision.
Sure. They submitted one paper, and what they're claiming is that one half of one factor supports the arbitrator's decision. And let me tell you what they state there. They state the answer, the factor asks, fees paid by the health benefit plan issuer to reimburse similarly qualified out-of-network providers for the same services or supplies in the same region. What Aetna answered, and what they're claiming is substantial evidence, is the following. Yes, the original amount reimbursement allowed for this claim represents internal benchmark values established using various factors, including but not limited to reimbursement allowed for similarly qualified out-of-network providers for the same services or supplies. The reimbursement allowed for this claim during the initial adjudication process was based on rates that are approximately 2 times the rate identified in Medicare's resource-based relative value system. The amounts offered in the pre-arbitration negotiation were almost 4 times. That is not any evidence. These statements are roundly contradicted by actual evidence that was presented by Dr. Nazarian. He provided 9 explanation of benefits of how he was paid by Aetna and other insurance companies that paid his rate or higher rates.
Don't you agree that the system that's set up by Section 1467, I think it could definitely be considered and classified as non-adversarial, and I think it could even be considered and qualified and considered as like quasi-evidentiary. I mean, it sounds like the way that the reading of the statute is that these things that are submitted, these statements, although they may not be admissible in a court of law, they are still considered evidence under the framework of 1467. Do you agree with that?
I respectfully don't agree with that. And the reason why is because they can say anything that they want. They can say, we pay $1 for this. If it's not supported by evidence, it's not evidence. And I believe that would affect the provider's due process rights. Because this is their livelihood. This is how they make money. This is how they treat patients. If they can't do this, and if they can't get fairly compensated for the work that they do, there will not be emergency room physicians.
We understand that. But again, this is kind of a policy argument. I want to ask you a question. I want to go back to the answer you gave to Justice Kerr, and that is, you know, isn't it true under Government Code 2001.174 that the AB is very specific, and it says that a reviewing court under the substantial evidence threshold may not, this is a quotation, may not substitute its judgment for that of the state agency. You agree with that?
I agree.
And your argument is that it's not a state agency, this was an arbitrator, right?
Well, I agree with the statement that you made. There are two arguments to what you had just mentioned. So yes, number one, that it's not a state agency decision, and number two, Chapter 1467 supersedes that. Basically, that Chapter 1467 specifically states within the statute a court is allowed to determine the amount due.
But it does not specifically say that they can, that it doesn't actually, the language isn't that they have the ability to set a specific amount. It's simply, the language in the statute itself says that they have the right to whether or not decide if it's appropriate, I believe, something like that. I'm not quoting it perfectly, but it doesn't specifically give the reviewing court the opportunity to actually set a specific amount. You can concede that?
I respectfully don't, Your Honor. The specific language within the statute does say that a court, and I can get the specific language. Would you like me to?
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Quickly. Let me just find it really quick. Not later, 1467.089b. It's not later than the 45th day after the date of an arbitrator's decision under section 1467.088. A party not satisfied with the decision may file an action to determine the payment due to an out-of-network provider. So it does specifically say that. I also called the TDI, and I confirmed with them, and they said that once it's done with arbitration, it's in the court's hand. It can't even be remanded back to arbitration.
And I know you say that in your brief. And the question I have on that is, so if we did remand it, what are they going to do?
They can't, because so it did happen. So there was a case before this, MP Plastic Surgery versus United Healthcare. That case was remanded. When I called TDI, because I thought it was possible to be remanded, they said, we can't do this. It's a violation of the statute. You can only submit arbitration 90 days after initial payment has been made. The system does not allow it back in, and TDI cannot allow it back to be remanded.
So you think they would just simply ignore our remand?
They completely ignored it. Even till today, they specifically said, we're not allowed to have this remanded. And the TDI portal will not accept it. It can't be accepted, and they will not.
Well, I can understand why they wouldn't want to accept it if it's such a volume business. They don't want to have to redo things
more than once. And they specifically.
Let me get back to the substantial evidence question. Is your argument there's no substantial evidence here simply because they only considered one half of the factor? Or is your argument basically what Aetna said was farcical?
I believe that both. So I think that them contending that one half of one factor is substantial evidence, I believe that standing alone does not constitute more than a mere scintilla of evidence, number one. And then number two, I believe that their answer does not answer the question. The fact that they're saying we pay this times Medicare, I believe is a way for insurance companies to bring in Medicare rates. Like, we're paying 200 times Medicare. And I would just like to let you know a little bit about Medicare.
But how do we know that? How can we make the decision whether it's farcical or not?
Well, because, I mean, I think it's widely known that Medicare, the government has a lot of people to insure, the most out of any insurance company, and they have to do so within a federally constrained budget. Private insurance companies, they receive premiums from employees or employers who have a large number of employees. And, you know, the premiums that even the Medicare gets is still within a constrained budget.
Isn't that a question for the arbitrator to resolve?
Well, I think that a lot of these arbitrators, you know, I don't know how in-depth they look at these. And when you stick Medicare rates in there, I think it's misleading to the arbitrators.
Well, maybe I misheard you earlier, but I thought that one of your arguments was that, yes, Aetna just said we pay this much times Medicare, but you also said something about some specific evidence that Dr. Nazarian had submitted on his getting reimbursed as an out-of-network provider from Aetna in other situations, and it was more. So are you saying that the balancing of the evidence, or you're saying they had no evidence and you had some evidence?
Well, I believe that what they said does not constitute evidence at all. And the second point that I wanted to make is that it's the statement that they made that we pay two times Medicare is not right, because we have evidence within the record that they pay higher than that. We showed them that. We have 9 explanation of benefits of how them and other insurance companies have paid. And physicians have large malpractice insurance that they have to keep. They have employees that they have to keep. It's a big public policy concern. And I understand what you're saying, that this arbitration was set up to resolve issues and, you know, kind of get them to become contracted with the insurance companies. But it's very difficult, because insurance companies are just going to pay, especially with this arbitration process, they're just going to pay whatever they want, and they're going to say, go fight it. And when we try to fight it, they're not going to get paid again. So it's affecting the livelihood of these physicians, and I believe eventually it's going to affect the public.
So what sort of test do you want us to articulate
to determine
this case, as far as, yes?
I think that if you look at the evidence presented in here, the evidence all points in favor for Dr. Nazarian to be paid his actual rate. He spent over 100 hours in the direct and indirect care of this patient. He cleared a 99% blockage of a heart. I would also like to mention their answer to the circumstances of the complexity of the case is also misleading, because what they did there was they snuck in a CPT code. They said the CPT code pays this much amount. What I would like to tell the court is that, like, for example, a 99% blockage of the heart and a 25% blockage of the heart falls under the same CPT code. A 99% blockage of the heart is much more complicated to clear, and it's life-threatening if he doesn't clear it in the detail that he does. He has to stay at the hospital. He has to be on call. He has to speak to worried family members. He has to speak to other specialties who are there covering this patient. He can't go home and rest. He doesn't have time to do that.
But the problem is, and what Justice Kerr is really asking is, we've got to figure out what a test. We've got to figure out a way to analyze this legally. And I have to go back to the government code and the APA, because it actually says that reviewing courts have two options. They have to affirm in whole or in part, or reverse and remand. And I guess you're saying that part of the substantial evidence section of the APA just doesn't apply, because it's superseded by the TDI section, the insurance section, 1467. But, I mean, it's still a part of the government code that tells reviewing courts how to apply the substantial evidence standard. And it limits the reviewing courts to either, you know, reversing and remanding, or affirming in whole or in part. And so... I understand you say that they say that they won't accept it, or they'll just ignore it, but the standards that we have that are written in the law right now makes it sound like our hands are tied in what we can do. Do you understand that component?
Well, no, I understand completely what you're saying, and I've discussed this with so many people, and what my understanding of it, and after I've researched case law, which I put in my brief, is that when new laws enacted, the legislature had full understanding of previous law, and the one that is the newly enacted one is the one that governs. And because Chapter 1467 was the newly enacted law, and it says that the court has the right to determine the payment due to the out-of-network provider, I believe that is what should be done.
And the other thing I think, too, the thing that is a limitation on what we're able to do is, you know, 1467 doesn't say that you apply the substantial evidence standard that's found in the APA, but you ignore the procedural posture requirements of that section. It doesn't say that. You know, it directs us to this section, and this is what this section says.
No, I understand that completely. But again, my position on that is that although the APA does state that, it was before the enactment of this statute. And this statute specifically says that the court is allowed to determine the amount due. When I spoke to the TDI, because I was trying to get some guidance on it as well, they specifically told me that the court must determine the amount due. But also, I'd like to state one more thing, because I have 30 seconds, is that there was another way substantial evidence was not met. There was a statutory violation. Each party has an opportunity, or Dr. Nazarian did not have an opportunity to review the submission and write a written response to the submission.
That's your due process argument?
Yeah, and that's a violation of statutory law as well.
Yeah, did Aetna, as I'm recalling, Aetna said that that argument was not made in the trial court?
I did. It's on page 62 of my, am I allowed to go over or no?
I'll let you answer this one question. Yeah. Point us to the record where you're talking about.
And let me just grab it really quick. It is on page 62 of the first supplemental record. I put in my TRCP statement. Can I grab it real quick?
That's okay. We can look it up.
Okay. I said that in this arbitration process, this is what happens, and he did not have the opportunity to object.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Reply or rebuttal?
I will try to keep this brief. All those arguments that you just heard go to the weight of the evidence and they go to policy. Those are matters for the arbitrator and the legislature, not for a court. The rules of evidence don't apply here. That's why evidentiary standards that you normally apply in a full, like a de novo review, are not appropriate. And we agree that the law is not necessarily a model of clarity as far as what this court is to do. But I think the legislature knew what it was doing when it used substantial evidence as the standard of review.
Well, real quick, though, I mean, you say that the rules, you know, we do have to, if it's de novo, we have to figure out whether or not there was substantial evidence.
Correct.
You concede that?
Yes, okay. Certainly. And I think, what I'm trying to say is I don't think there's a new substantial evidence standard here that the court needs to divine. I think the legislature used substantial evidence
intentionally.
Yes, thank you. Very intentionally, because of the nature of this process and what it's intended to do and the sheer volume of claims that are coming through this. If these cases get appealed and they get, you know, an in-depth review, this system is not going to work. It's going to fall apart, and out-of-network medical bills are never going to go away. And that is simply not what the legislature intended. And I just want to say, like, to summarize, the question here is not whether the initial amount that Aetna paid the provider was more reasonable than the amount the provider billed. The question here is not whether Aetna's final pre-arbitration settlement offer was more reasonable than the provider's. And the question here is not even whether we think the arbitrator's decision was correct. The only question here is whether there's some evidence in the record to support the arbitrator's decision, and there is. It's on page 97. We've talked about it before, and the appellee, as the party initially contesting the decision, had the burden of establishing that there was no evidence in the record, and that burden simply has not been met here.
Let me jump in, because your time's coming up. What do you want us to do? Because
sure.
if we remand to TDI, you've heard what could potentially happen. I mean,
Sure. I don't think a remand is necessary, because there's substantial evidence in the record. The trial court got it wrong when it reversed. It should have affirmed, and this court should correct that and reverse the final judgment from the trial court and affirm the arbitrator's decision. And that's an easy decision, because the evidence supporting the arbitrator's determination of the reasonable amount is on page 97 of the record.
In essence, we would reverse the trial court.
Correct.
And render in accordance with the arbitrator's
Correct.
Judgment.
Yes, Judge. There are no further questions.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful. And with that, your case is submitted and you're free to go. Thank you.